after our meeting.
2 o'clock.
The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. It's Tuesday, April 2nd, 2013. We want to approve the prior commission meeting minutes. Is there a motion to do that? Senator Hayden moves that we approve. I'm sure you've all read them to make sure your name is spelled correctly. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That was the March 19th minutes. Let's start with TRA, since we've kept Ms. Hacking waiting so many times in the past. Just a brief reminder of what we're doing, because we've had you before us in that lovely spring suit. It's beautiful. Thank you.
It's old.
So it's warm.
Yeah.
Just a brief reminder. Yeah.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Laurie Hacking with the Teachers Retirement Association. Just a reminder about what this bill attempts to do. As you may recall, I explained previously that our actuary recommended a very dramatic change in the methodology that's used for changing or for calculating the early retirement reduction factors. It's a fairly large change, and that results in pretty significant reductions in early retirement benefits. So what the bill attempts to do is to partially mitigate those reductions. There would still be fairly significant reductions, even under this bill, for the early retirees prior to age 62. And we restructured this so that restructured the factors in the bill so that for persons who are attain age 62 with 30 years of service, they would get better factors. And we restructured this for the purpose of trying to provide a strong incentive for teachers to remain in the workforce and teaching to 62 and beyond that age. So in a nutshell, that's what the bill does.
Any questions for Ms. Hacking? Is there a motion to amend this into Omnibus 2?
So moved.
So moved. Senator Representative Nelson moves that Senate File 529, House File 650 be recommended to pass and incorporated into Omnibus Bill 2. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to briefly comment on this proposal? Do you want to comment now or on a later one? Or
time is any.
Just on this one then?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Crockett.
It's not warm enough yet for my spring suit, so
I agree.
I haven't dug them out. I'll get there. I did bring a bunch of stuff today, and one of them, and I don't know who's interested in a copy, and I can send electronic ones, but just as something to think about, the state of Florida offers its teachers options for retirement options, both DBs, defined benefits, and defined contribution plans. And there's a terrific paper here from the Fordham Institute, which I'd be happy to share. Give you a copy first.
If that's okay.
I only brought, five or six, but again, I can share this electronically with any member of the commission or all.
If you want to send it to Ms. Dieslin electronically, I'm sure,
sure
she'll forward it to us.
It's maybe not of interest this session, but in general, especially those of you who are new to the commission and will want to re-up. Want to say at the start, because I know we'll get crunched for time, a general comment that would apply to any of the items on the agenda, and I see that I am the testifier tonight. These unfunded liabilities are backed by taxpayers, just to sort of set a general reminder. That's my job. It's one thing if the funds find themselves short from time to time due to market fluctuations, but the current situation is not solely caused by a bad market in 2008. The funds are not fully funded because the state has been promising greater benefits than it is paying for in forms of contributions, both from employers employees and whatever the State Board of Investment yields. And so to continue to entertain these tweaks and even increases in benefits such as the one before us with TRA, I was expecting an amendment, frankly, and didn't think I was going to get up. But even to entertain these smaller items to a pension system that's around 70% funded really shoves the cost of today's government onto the shoulders of future taxpayers and generations. This violates Minnesota's own pension principles, as we discussed early in the session, where there was some discussion of reviewing those pension principles, and it violates any sense of fair play. As to TRA in particular, what comes to mind is when you were in a hole, stop digging. I note from the staff's memo on this, again, I expected maybe a revision, but it's not here, that this reduces the cut in certain retirees' benefits, I believe, that are caused by the 2010 omnibus bill. It gives them a bigger cushion that drains the TRA assets, and it ignores the current funding deficiency by increasing what the staff referred to as financial difficulties. And I keep hearing that we should give the 2010 omnibus bill time to work. So this bill seems impatient to me at best and imprudent given TRA's funding status, which is about 73%. And just to remind very busy members, it's reporting a $6.2 billion unfunded liability for 2012, which is up from $5 billion in 2011. So if this is the only legislation, with all due respect, coming from TRA this year, perhaps it would be better to see what they have to offer in the interim for a long-term recovery plan for TRA.
Any questions, Madam Chair, for Ms. Crockett? Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And to the Hayden motion, all those in favor, Senator Rosen?
Are we voting on the bill, Madam Chair?
Oh, is Nelson?
Yeah, Nelson, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator Rosen?
We are voting on this bill.
We're voting on this
bill. I'm sorry. Could I please ask?
Please do.
Thank you. I was wondering if there is any cost or any savings with these changes on the actuarial assumption, if you could explain those.
Ms.
I'm
Hacking.
Sorry, I came in late.
That's okay. And Ms. Hacking has talked about those in previous meetings, but we need reminders. So, Ms. Hacking.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there is a if you adopt this bill, the actuary has estimated that it could save as much as 0.3% of pay. That's using certain assumptions about retirement patterns, and or it could cost as much as 0.1, which is relatively slight. My sense is that it would probably be somewhere in the middle is where the cost estimate would turn out to be a slight savings. Now, that is, to explain, that's relative to our current factors that we are currently using. If you did not adopt this bill, then these fairly severe early retirement reductions would go into effect, and there would be a savings of 0.86% of pay. So basically what the bill attempts to do is to not spend any more than what we are currently assuming to spend in our valuations, et cetera. So it does not add any costs over and above what we're looking at now in our current valuations. But if we proceed without doing the bill, there are fairly significant savings to the fund and fairly significant cuts in these early retirement benefits. So what we're trying to do is mitigate those cuts, preserve, we think, some of the savings, not all of the savings, but preserve some of the savings.
Senator Rosen. Did you finish, Ms. Hacking?
I was just going to say, and to the to Ms. Crockett's earlier testimony about our funding situation, I think we've met with each of you individually and have laid out our numbers to you. And We are watching our funding level and our deficiency very closely, and if there is not a significant improvement in that deficiency, we will be coming back with recommendations, as we did in 2010. It's a little early to know whether that's absolutely necessary or not, because that's, as you recall, that can be a painful process. But nonetheless, our board has committed to watching this very closely and making recommendations if they are needed, when they are needed.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hacking, I guess I did think when you were in my office that this was going to be proposed next year, so it was more of a briefing of that this could be the potential plan for a next year's bill. Did I read that wrong?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen.
Probably.
Yeah. We were intending it for this year. I think maybe to clarify, we are proposing a phase-in of this bill, meaning the factors would be phased in, both the negative factors and the positive factors. So they will be phased in over a gradual period of time so that there are not abrupt changes in people's anticipated benefits. Maybe that's what you were recalling, that there is some delayed implementation with the phase-in period.
Any more questions on the TRA bill? Then on the Nelson motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, I'd like to take up the St. Paul bill next. And Mr. Doan, if you could just give us a little summary of that one. The tab number 4. And there is an amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And to summarize, we've talked this over at some length over several hearings. I'll summarize kind of the basic features. You recall our most recent valuation indicated a funding shortfall, a deficiency, in essence, of about $17 million. And the board, after considering various options, has come up with a package that it feels is very balanced. It spreads the costs over the various participants to the system, and we feel it's a fair and a balanced approach to resolving this problem. And the board feels very strongly that it's important to move at this time rather than to continue marking time or not taking action. Obviously, these kinds of things are solved more cost-effectively sooner rather than to a delay. So we have several features here. Of the $17 million, about $7 million of that will be made up by actions by the board itself, things that are currently in the pipeline that it's agreed to do. It's proposing to save an additional $3.5 million, or to add $3.5 million, in essence, to solve the $17 million shortfall through a series of steps, including an adjustment to the early retirement table, a modification of the return to work program, some savings there, some savings in the early retirement schedule, some savings from an increase in employee and employer contributions, and there is a change in the multiplier that would bring us equivalent to the TRA level at 1.9. That is a cost to the system, but it is more than fully funded by the employees themselves with a over 1% increase over 2 years scheduled for employee future contributions. And then the other key feature is the state's contribution, which we're requesting a $7 million annual appropriation over the next up to 25-year period. That would, in essence, address the shortfall. So roughly $10 million of the $17 million shortfall is being addressed by the board itself and its participants, and $7 million, the balance, is sought from the state at this time. And I did have one other item, Madam Chairman, that I wanted to bring to the attention of the commission this afternoon. That is one final amendment. If you recall,
that's
our original
14A amendment, members you have in your packets.
14A, correct. And to just describe what this does, if you would recall, the original proposal that we had called for both the employees and employers to make a contribution for those folks who are retired teachers who go back to work for the St. Paul School District. We currently have that so-called return to work program. Currently, there is no contribution assessed on those people going back to work. It means that a position is being filled, but the fund itself is not receiving any benefit from that individual that's there. And we had requested and got strong endorsement from the school board that that was a gap that needed to be addressed. So we assessed an employer a contribution, a standard contribution of the employer and for the employee. Then it became a question about whether it was possible to assess an employee contribution when they were, in effect, already retired and would not be receiving any future benefit. So we decided that in the interest of addressing the issue and not having it being a continuing concern, we removed that from the bill. But I did contact and receive the support of the school system to, in essence, their willingness to make up some of that contribution that's lost by the lack of an employee contribution on return to work employees. And they've agreed to pay 2.5% of the 6.5% that otherwise would be the normal employee contribution. So it's a very important and meaningful gesture on the part of the school administration. Again, I think it acknowledges their endorsement to the package and the desire to have the fully funded program that's outlined here in front of you succeed and address the issue of the funding deficiency and ensure the continued sustainability of the system going forward. So,
Representative Lesch moves the 14A amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Are there any questions for Mr. Doan about the St. Paul proposal? Then Representative Lesch moves that Senate File 1249, House File 1433 is amended, be recommended to pass and incorporated into Omnibus Bill 2. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
We're not having any testifiers?
We did.
Oh, she's all done. Okay.
Yeah, we've had this. We've held these bills over like 3 weeks.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I could ask for testifiers. We did last time. Ms. Crockett wanted to come back up again. She's the only one who signed up.
Well, I can say the same thing we did the last two times.
Senator Tom. Senator Tom.
Chair, request a roll call.
Let's give you a second.
Okay. Roll call's been requested.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, I guess my question for the commissioners would be, what's the rush? Mr. Doan makes the argument that it's more cost-effective for whom? I don't know. The Minnesota taxpayer certainly needs to be in consideration here. It seems that if you bail this fund out because their only problem has been a rough stock market and poor investment returns, that we all hope will continue to improve and rebound until the next downturn in the market. But if you think that there's more going on here than just poor investment returns, both for this fund and Duluth, then you don't kick this can down the road. Unlike Duluth, St. Paul doesn't seem to be upside down in terms of membership, active to retired. But if this is a candidate for a merger with TRA, it seems like that ought to be considered before you do a bailout, any kind of state aid. In order to hold TRA harmless, I would think that would take a lot of caution and time to work out the details of that. And it just seems to me, sitting from my vantage point, of why would you give them a cash deal without exerting control over the fund? And I don't know what the answer is, you know, is to that. It just doesn't seem like there's an emergency here with this one, and that you would take time to look at other options before putting the taxpayer, cash out on this one. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. I guess just since my name's on this bill, I would just say that this is kind of a shared pain approach. because the employer is paying more, the employee is paying more, and the state is being asked to contribute more to stabilize the fund, and that it couldn't go into TRA unless it was closer to being fully funded. And Mr. Doan has given a presentation before us earlier about the costs of merger at this point would be roughly $30 million. But if we are thinking that that might be down the road, to bring the benefits in line with TRA is probably a good move, and to start putting some cash in infusion from the state into the fund is probably a good move.
Well, I don't know if it's appropriate for me to ask a question, but Madam Chair, is bringing it in line with TRA benefits, which increases the cost at this time when it's in trouble, that strikes me, again, sitting from my vantage point, as not a responsible or ethical move. I don't know if it's something that's required before a merger. I don't know enough about it. That would be something that Lori Hacking would have to tell us, or Mr. Doan. But again, from my vantage point, to raise benefits when a fund is in trouble just seems backwards.
Mr. Doan.
But I appreciate your thinking in terms of steps.
Right. Mr. Doan.
Madam Chairman, my response would be that there's no real justification for awarding a benefit package to every teacher district differently than St. Paul, and that if you're going to attract and continue to attract good teachers and good professionals within the teaching ranks for St. Paul, then I think it's only fair that their benefit structure and their contribution structure be comparable. So it's not an attempt to sort of bring them up. If the wisdom of the legislature down the line is to bring the systems together at some point, which isn't justifiable in my mind on a variety of reasons, but if that was the decision, then yes, it would be necessary, and people who were in the same system will have to receive the same benefit. People in the same system would have to pay the same contribution, so there would be the importance of having that in a parallel form. So there's nothing that is taken into account with this bill that would undo that course of action if that was felt appropriate down the line. I just respond one other thing. When you said, what's the rush here? We've been in existence for 109 years or 104 years or something since 1909. The state, through that whole period, has been rather parsimonious in terms of their support for the system. And I don't think to say that we're rushing into this after 100 and some odd years is, in fact, quite accurate. I think, in fact, we're taking measured steps here. We're doing something that is appropriate, something that acting today will be less costly than acting tomorrow, just by the nature of the way the defined benefit plan operates and liabilities grow. And this is a time to nip that in the bud and resolve that problem and set it on a firm footing to resolve any deficiencies going forward. So I think it's a very timely and justifiable step.
Okay.
Just one more thought. Again, I brought along just a sample. Michigan does this. Florida does this. They have teachers in defined contribution plans. And one of the ways to attract young teachers, and I hope Duluth is listening too, because the declining population is not necessarily in their future if they start thinking out of the box. If you want to attract young people to the profession, think about offering them a defined contribution. And I know that you and I, Madam Chair, have had some dialogue about that, and I have done some research on some new thinking on it. And again, I offer you the Florida story where their teachers have an option between a defined benefit and a defined contribution, which is particularly attractive to people who may not want a 35-year career in teaching, or for women who see themselves as maybe leaving the profession to raise kids or move with a husband for his career. All of those things that we go through, a defined contribution is something that might attract different people to the St. Paul teachers or Duluth teachers or any teacher system here in the state of Minnesota, and it's something I think we need to consider.
Members, at the end of the meeting, we're going to discuss our interim hearing schedule, And I think Ms. Crockett brings up a good point. There was a study that was done last year by the plans on defined contributions and I think conversion to defined contributions, and a lot of the members are new. And so I think it'd be a good idea if we revisit that study and have a discussion about that.
Well, and when I recover from my faint from what you just said, that you would consider inviting me into that conversation. Minnesota's study and our discussion of that was actually mentioned in two major national reports recently, and that's what I was referring to when I said recent research that may show us a way that we weren't aware of at that time, and I'll be happy to share that with you when you're ready for it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
On the Lesch motion, the secretary will take the roll. The chair votes yes.
Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
Senator Hayden?
Yes.
Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Senator Rosen?
No.
Senator Saxhog?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Representative Benson?
No.
Representative Kahn?
Yes.
Representative Lesch?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
10-4. Yep. On a vote to 10-4, 10 in favor, 4 opposed, the motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dohm. Then we'll move to number 3 on the agenda, which is the Duluth bill. Mr. Stoffel. It's the third tag. Here it is. Welcome back, and if you would like to give us a summary, please, of your proposal as a reminder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And maybe a little history.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. We thought that we'd give a little history about the fund and how we got to the point where we're at, and then explain.
Just introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Johnson. I'm an attorney that represents the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association. And to start, the history of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund, it was established in 1910, which is 103 years ago, and they have a history of being fiscally responsible and dealing with their pension plan funding in a sound manner. In 1921, the DTRFA was only 10% funded. At that time, the trustees reorganized the plan, and they did so by reducing benefits, increasing contributions, and adopting sound actuarial principles. Under the changes, benefits were reduced by a quarter. Contribution rates were established based on actuarial principles, which back at that time frame was not something that all plans were doing. We went back after the last Pension Commission meeting and did some research on the history of the fund. And we found one of the actuarial reports from 1922. And they had at that time calculated a normal cost, which the fund ended up exceeding by 1% because they wanted to fund the plan quicker than what the actuary was suggesting. And it was a percent more than what the normal cost was. The city of Duluth was also at that time permitted to levy property taxes in order to pay down the unfunded liability. And at that time, the valuation showed that the fund was in a good condition, and if it continued on its present basis, they would be fully able to meet its liabilities. The actuary said in 1921 they were one of the few cities in the country which was operating a sound retirement plan for its teachers. And since then, they've continued to do the same. During the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the employee and employer contribution rates were gradually increased to address higher salaries and mortality improvements. And DTRFA achieved 100% funding status and had a surplus as far back as 1965. And one of the things that would, in terms of the continuing action and the things that they did, they were fiscally prudent with respect to the benefit side of the equation at all. They had an employer additional contribution, which was the regular employer contribution rate was set at 4%, and there was an additional 1% added to the employer rate to go towards a small unfunded liability. And at that time, the plan was about 80% funded. And from 1958 to 78, the employer was paying an additional 1% into the fund. Then in 1979, because the unfunded liability was beginning to grow as a result of investments at the time, the employer rate was again increased to 1.29%. And for the next 32 years, that's what happened. And the total, in total, there was 53 years of the employer having an additional contribution rate on the employer side of the equation with respect to the Duluth teachers. On the benefits side, we were careful to control benefits. Unlike other Minnesota teacher pension plans, Duluth has never had a basic plan, which is a plan that is not coordinated with Social Security, which has a much higher benefit structure and higher actuarial funding requirements. We've never had a 30 and out benefit as others had, and although some ad hoc COLAs were paid to the Duluth teachers during the 60s and the 70s, DTRA had no regular COLA or investment-based retirement adjustment until 1985. And what this ended up to was this, is that from 1962 to 1969, in 1973, in 1990, from 1992 to 1994, and from 1998 to 2004, DTRFA was over 90% funded. It was over 100% funded from 1965 to 1969 and from 2000 to 2002. And why this history and the funded nature of how the way Duluth has traditionally and historically treated its benefit structure and the employer and employee contributions it gave, we think matters to this commission, is the following. We've never asked for much state assistance from the state of Minnesota. In the 103-year history of the plan, we have received direct state aid only 9 years. Most funds have a 20-year or longer history of receiving such aid. We received no state aid before 1998, and from 1998 to 2002, we received less than $500,000 annually in such aid. Then it was discontinued. In the last 4 years, we've received state aid that has averaged $580,000 per year. And the state aid that has been paid to DTRFA is significantly less relative to other Minnesota pension funds by any measure, including percentage of covered payroll, per member basis, or a percentage of unfunded liability. And we also went back and did an analysis of how much state aid and supplemental state aid has been appropriated over the last 20 years. And the state of Minnesota, by our estimates, has appropriated approximately $595 million in supplemental amortization aid to various local public pension fund plans. Of that amount, DTRFAs received $4.7 million, which is less than 1% of all such aids appropriated. There's been a simple reason for that. We haven't asked for the help, and we haven't needed the help. But there have been a number of events that have occurred that have been outside our control in the last decade that have led to the current situation, and we've discussed those previously. They included the stock market crash of 2000 and the global economic crisis of 2008 and 2009. They included legislative changes that had an impact in DTRFA, which included legislation moving teaching faculty from the local community college into TRA and IRAP plans, and legislation that immediately removed all charter school teachers in Duluth from the membership ranks of the DTRFA and transferred them into TRA. And then the demographics, which to us is a significant concern, and it has been a concern that will be continuing with respect to how this fund moves forward. We've seen a dramatic change over the last 2 to 3 decades, as we've testified to previously. The active and contributing members have diminished to 900, while the members' number of benefit recipients has grown to 1,400. And the causes of this primarily are the enrollment at the school district has steadily fallen for the last 20 years from over 14,000 students in 1995 to under 9,000 today. And there have been pressures causing the school district to downsize teaching staff. And that is, you know, the sum of all of that has been that the pension plan has dropped from being 96% funded on a market value basis in 2000 to 60% funded in 2012. with a contribution deficiency of 8.5%. In 2010, like many other Minnesota public pension funds, we took steps to try and address that situation. Those steps did not include asking for state aid, additional state aid. What they did include was sacrifices by active teachers, by retirees in the school district. These changes, which included increasing the employee contribution rate, increasing the employer contribution rate, increasing the vesting requirement, and a suspension of the COLA for retirees, reduced the DTRFA's liability by $61.6 million. And with respect to the COLA, one of the things we would talk about, would like to just reiterate, because there was some discussion of this before, but in 2010, when we came before the commission and proposed suspending our COLA, we received criticism for that. Pension Commission staff noted that the COLA, the reducing and eliminating the COLA, was a draconian move. It was very draconian, and there was questions as to whether it was a viable solution. Members on the commission made statements like the following. I'm extremely uncomfortable at the suggestion with the COLA at zero for what I believe could be a very long period of time. There should be, in fact, periodic increases in benefits with regard to cost of living so that ultimately your benefit is not diminished over time. And so I just think we should be cautious about and very cognizant of some of the very long-term serious implications of suspending the COLA the way we did. The commission allowed us to do it anyway because we made arguments about how it was consistent with us being conservative. And so for a number of years now, we have not received any COLA. On January 1st of this year, every single retiree in all Minnesota public pension plans, approximately 184,000 in all, received a COLA. Only the 1,400 retirees of the DTRFA did not receive one and have not for 3 years. And absent legislative change, this will continue to be the case. Many of the retirees that receive the COLA are in pension plans that receive significant amounts of state aid, are in plans that have lower funded ratio than the DTRFA. What we're asking for with respect to the COLA is equitable treatment for our retirees in regards to the cost of living adjustment. And finally, we would just reference the consolidation discussion once again. Mr. Banian, who I think is with the Free Market Institute, testified at the last Pension Commission hearing about maybe it's time for the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund to consolidate. And we just want to be clear, we've had a long-standing position with respect to consolidation. The DTRFA will support a merger if it makes sense for its membership and if it makes sense for the state. And over the last 20 years, merger of DTRFA has been considered and discussed. In the last few months, there's been discussions between TRA and DTRFA with respect to what it's going to take for these funds to consolidate, what are the parameters, what are the precedents that have been set by previous pension fund consolidations that some of the members of this commission are familiar with. Those discussions will continue over the interim, and we will continue to look at that issue because we are concerned about the demographics. We just want to be clear, however, just as is the case with St. Paul, it needs to be understood that a merger of the DTRFA with TRA will require greater funding than what is contained in the stabilization package as originally proposed by the DTRFA or what's contained in the amendment being discussed today. Preliminary calculations, because the DTRFA went and had its actuary run the numbers, basically to bring DTRFA into TRA by our preliminary calculations is over $14 million a year for 25 years to bring it in fully funded so that TRA teachers are not subsidizing DTRFA teachers. I'd also point out that TRA needs to sign off on this too. They've looked at it, and their numbers are much higher. And so there needs to be a discussion between funds about whether which number is correct and agree on what is the exact number. But just for purposes of this discussion, we think it's important for people to understand that what we're asking for or what consolidation means is a much higher number, a significantly higher number than what we're asking for today. Agreement on the actuarial impacts will be critical, as has been the case with every other pension fund consolidation merger that's happened in the last 15 years. Those discussions and that agreement will be critical to whether a consolidation can even occur. There will also be numerous other issues that will need to be resolved, and the history of the other consolidations show that how they're resolved will determine whether consolidation will be successful or not. There's a body of work around previous consolidations, some that have been as successful, others not so successful. And the distinguishing factors between the two are agreement on the actuarial costs, agreement on how the merger occurs, agreement on a uniformity of benefits, and a structure that works for all sides. Those are the things that will be talked about and have been talked about, but those are the things necessary to consolidation. So I just make clear that we're not necessarily opposed to consolidation. We think it's something that may have to occur at some point, and we wouldn't disagree with Mr. Banian about his testimony. But there's a significant cost involved. And what we're proposing with respect to our package of normalizing benefits with TRA and providing funding, stabilization funding to stabilize the fund given what's gone on, will help in the consolidation discussion as it moves forward, if that's the route that folks want us to go and decide is the best course for the members to go, as well as help with the current situation, a situation that is almost entirely not within its control and not consistent with the history of the fund. So we can go into what the other components are, Madam Chair, if that's what you'd like to do, or we could stand for questions. But that's why we're here today. That's why we would appreciate your consideration with respect to the stabilization of this fund. We haven't been here often, but we need the help now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful and very interesting history. Are there any questions from members of the commission? Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's probably as much a statement as it is a question, so it'll be rhetorical and don't really expect an answer. But the fact is, I think I've shared with the committee and the testifiers my opposition, and it's not so much as I don't believe that you need help. I absolutely do believe that you need help. I'm not so sure, as it was used by previously by Ms. Crockett, that it's the best to quote, rush in. It's just going to pass, and I'm aware of that. Probably there's no doubt that a lot of money is going to have to be invested in your plan in order to bring it into TRA at some point. And so maybe this is the way to begin that process. I don't know. But I just make folks mindful of the fact that the court ruled last week in Stockton case of bankruptcy, and a bigger portion of the reason why they're in that shape is because of their pension plans. And most of what their problem was in Stockton is the same kind of problems that we see in Duluth. It's the demographics and many of the same things. So I thought you spoke pretty wisely, Madam Chair. Didn't raise my hand the last time when you said that in the interim we need to look at these things. I would only hope there are, I think, more than one of us, a couple of us potentially, that are very interested in continuing the conversation and looking for different opportunities to address the issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Benson. Anyone else? Any questions? We have a request from Mr. Triden. Is Mr. Triden here? Trinan. Sorry. Mr. Triden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commission members. I appreciate the opportunity.
Just repeat your name, please, for the tape.
I'm sorry?
Repeat your name, please.
My name is Tom Trinan. I'm
you.
A retired Duluth Elementary School principal, and I am here to speak with you tonight about three different areas. And I have a few other people I've been talking to. They weren't able to make it tonight, but I speak for them as well. The first thing I'd like to address is the House File 1330, Senate File 1235, or 1245, and I'd like to speak for the children on this one. I know that we have a very serious funding challenge for the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. I think Mr. Johnson did a very nice job of outlining that for us, and we do need help, and I appreciate any help that can be forthcoming. This morning, Duluth News Tribune published an article, and it outlined the results of community meetings of what parents and teachers are looking for most. Their number one priority, and this is no surprise, is reduced class sizes and additional educational offerings. If the proposed increase in employer contribution goes through as part of the problem solving for the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund, it will mean the elimination of approximately 5 full-time teachers in Duluth. and will be counterproductive in terms of lowering class sizes and providing educational opportunities for the children in Duluth. And this will be on top of the 8 to 9 positions that were lost permanently in 2010 as the Duluth Pension Fund worked to solve the pension shortfall. So in short, the pension fund problem is a real one. It's one, however, I feel we as adults created. And I just want to stand firm that it is wrong in my mind to solve that problem on the backs of young kids in Duluth, Minnesota. The second thing I would like to talk about is the $16.7 billion unfunded liability that our state pension funds have as a whole. From 1996 through 2002, retirees in virtually all state pension plans received cost of living adjustments 3 to 4 times the cost of living. These very generous increases resulted in pension premiums, which were in some cases in excess of $100,000. And if you want to look at Table A that I have put together myself, you can see a little bit of the dynamics of how that occurred. These increases contributed heavily to the pension liability and at the same time set up huge disparities in what various retiree cohorts received during their retirement. At your last meeting, Mr. Rapinski and I proposed that cost of living adjustments be given only to those retirees whose pension increases have not kept pace with inflation. Doing rough calculations, if you look at tables B and C, you can see where such a line might be drawn. And I think that might just help you out. And those are just two examples for the Minnesota State Retirement System and for the Duluth Federation of Teachers, or excuse me, Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. Giving COLAs only to those retirees whose pension increases have not kept pace with inflation is not only the sensible thing to do, it would also provide some level of fairness to retiree cohorts, and it would help address the current pension fund liability that we face as a state, and that would involve all pension funds. Mr. Martin and the staff in his office are extremely capable and knowledgeable about these things, and I think it would be wise to look for them to them for the wording of what might happen so that we are moving towards sustainability. And the third thing I'd like to talk about is the future of Minnesota pensions. And some of this has already been addressed. But Chair Pappas, I was delighted to hear that there's going to be discussion about pension funding and other alternatives because we have a very serious problem. And I think it could be very helpful for all of us to take an honest and thoughtful look at the current system that focuses on stewardship, sustainability, and fairness. And I want to just review a little bit with you things that you're probably already aware of, but in 2006, because of funding problems or difficulties, the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund Association was merged into the TRA, costing Minnesota taxpayers $21.7 million per year in ongoing contributions. And if you want to look at Table D, it just kind of outlines some of these things for you. 4 short years later, in 2010, again, because of funding issues, and I think this is right, the Minnesota Employees Retirement Fund was merged into the state para fund, costing Minnesota taxpayers, again, $22.7 million in ongoing contributions. And 3 short years later, tonight, you are listening to and hearing testimony about the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund and the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. And as difficult as it is to deal with this, when you think about it, the shortfall in Duluth, Minnesota as of January 30th was $119 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but that's only 0.7% of the state unfunded liability. St. Paul's amount is slightly higher at 3.35%. But anyway, these are minimal amounts compared to the entire liability that we as Minnesotans face in our pension funds. And it leads me to ask the question at least, and perhaps you as well, which fund will be next? Or what do we prevent? What do we do to prevent another fund from becoming next? And this isn't to pick on TRA, but just looking at the funding levels, et cetera, that's in are in the reports. The TRA is currently 73% funded with a 5% contribution deficiency. And members are scheduled to get a 2% cost of living adjustment this year. Their fund currently has a $6.2 billion unfunded liability. I would ask Chair Pappas and commission members that action be taken quickly, and I don't know what that action would be, but I just know that the sooner action is taken, the better chance we have of coming to a long-term solution for our pension funds, our retirees, our current workers in the state system. And I urge you to, if that doesn't happen down the road, it's very likely that you yourselves or a group just like you will be looking at a much more serious problem than you're looking at tonight. I urge you to put together a group of your choosing, and again, Chair Pappas, it sounds like this may already be happening, to take a look at the state pension plan and to bring their recommendations back to you for consideration. The longer we wait, the larger the problem will become, and the more distasteful the choices will become as well. What we can do in the future truly depends on the choices we make today. And that's what I have to say. Thank you. I don't know if you have any questions or not, but
any questions for Mr. Tridham? Thank you very much for weighing in on this important issue.
Thank you for your time.
I don't think we could have said it.
All right. Any other discussion? Mr. Stoifel, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, my name is Jay Stoifel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. I have nothing more to add. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I figure out when you want to fix this?
Okay. Then we have an amendment for Duluth.
Already offered it.
No, that was for St. Paul. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Then Representative Murphy.
I move adoption.
Representative Murphy moves that Senate File 1235, House File 1330 be recommended to pass and incorporated into Omnibus Bill 2.
As previously amended.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members. Right, thank you very much. Then, I did forget to ask Ms. Crockett. Ms. Crockett, did you want to comment on the entire omnibus retirement bill? Okay. Then, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to comment on anything? Representative Benson, did you have an amendment?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. An amendment, I think Mr. Martin has the amendment to hand out or has a copy that Lisa can pass around. The amendment is an amendment that would add a third tier. Let me back up, make this as short as possible. I know what everybody wants to get out of here to go to the Duluth. So for full disclosure.
Ranger party. Be careful about that.
Yes.
Not the Duluth party. It's the range party.
Ranger party.
That's what got us to 430.
Thank you.
Sorry, Representative Benson.
So, full disclosure, I receive a pension, and it's a defined benefit pension from the U.S. government, a civil service pension that I took back in 2004. It was a reduction in force. I was riffed out of my position and took the retirement, and I'm glad I'm here. It gives me the opportunity to be here, of course, but I also took a significant reduction because I was young, early. But when I retired, back in the 1980s, the U.S. Postal Service decided that they could no longer take a look at civil service as an option viable and to fund it properly into the future. So they wisely made a decision that they would transform their retirement system into what is now the Federal Employees Retirement System, or FERS, which is a hybrid of minimal defined benefit and mostly defined contribution. So in 2004, when I was riffed and took my pension, I had the opportunity to speak to other executives in the Postal Service that were considering or retiring. And I kind of looked over my shoulder, and some of the folks who had made the decision to go to, they had the option of going to the defined contribution FERS program with the thrift savings where they could contribute quite a bit and manage that portfolio of investments. were really doing well, significantly better than me. And so I always thought to myself, coulda, woulda, shoulda, if back in the early 1980s, if I could have had at least the option of making a decision, would I have made it differently? And, of course, the answer was yes. So with that in mind, I had the opportunity to meet with a couple of the judges. In fact, again this afternoon, and Nancy Hawes, who probably will come to the table if there's some questions, to talk to them about adding a third tier to the judges' plan. And I know I'm fully aware of the political ramifications of their organization having gone through actually voting for the proposal that you have and before you that's currently in the omnibus bill. It's just tiers one and two. But tier three is an amendment that you have before you now that would offer a third option. And this option would be only for new hires or people who are not vested to five years back, a look back, that would give them the option that I wish I would have taken back in the 1980s to say, if I so desire, I would like a defined contribution plan rather than a defined benefit plan. Now, one of the things that I wanted to make sure that when I offered it is that it was not detrimental to their existing plans, tier one and tier two. So in this plan, the defined contribution plan, the employee pays in 9%, the same exact amount that Tier 1 currently pays. The employer would pay 9%, and that would go into the pool of money available to the retiree to invest in the manner they see fit, and the board that sees the investments or monitors their investments and so on. But an additional 13.5% would be paid by the state or the employer to make sure that Tier 1 and Tier 2 is funded in a manner necessary to keep that plan where we need it headed. Now, they're probably, as they came before you in the last 3 or 4 weeks, the most underfunded of the funds. And I'm cognizant of that, and I absolutely, when I fashioned the amendment, worked with Mr. Martin on it, wanted to make sure that we didn't go down in a road that I have an amendment before you that sabotages all the work that we're doing in the omnibus. So the amendment before you is an amendment that absolutely, in my mind and estimations and the opinions of at least Mr. Martin, I'm going to give him an ability to speak to that because I don't want to put words in his mouth, gives the judges the additional option of electing a retired contribution plan, something that we spoke about tonight as a way that maybe we'd want to go in the future for other plans. And that's simply it. Speaking to the issue of making sure that the part of the plan that's a defined contribution plan, our benefit plan, is properly funded. In fact, I think there are some slight indications. You never know. It's not an exact science because you don't know how many people are going to elect to take the defined contribution plan. But there is reason to believe that, in fact, it helps the plan. And I'll let Mr. Martin speak to that piece.
Mr. Martin, for comments.
Yes, members. The proposal here is to replace the retirement coverage for new judges and for a small segment of existing judges who have very short service, have them have the option to choose a defined contribution plan, to use the unclassified plan, which is our the same defined contribution plan that covers both legislative staff and covers new legislators after 1997. It would have a contribution structure of 9% member contribution and a 9% employer contribution. The current normal cost of the judge's plan in administrative expenses is 18.35%. So we're replacing essentially an 18% current actuarial cost with an 18% contribution stream for these judges. So they get essentially the same general sort of value as they currently have. The slight differential, the 0.35, is actually a savings to the judge's plan. The judicial branch continues to make the same employer contribution in total, with 13.5% of that total contribution going to the existing judges' plan to help amortize the unfunded of that plan. So this is building on the same notion that was presented in the judges' bill that you've added to Omnibus 2, and broadens it to the extent that there would be now, instead of a mandatory option of Tier 2 for new judges, new judges would have a choice between a stripped-down or more modest defined benefit plan, that's the original bill, is in Omnibus 2, or a defined contribution plan with a 9.9% structure, slightly larger member contribution than Tier 2, the same employer contribution, no matter what the choices of the judge. Judges are not probably the normal target group for a defined contribution plan. They don't have the same portability interests in the main as, say, college professors who may be moving on to some other some institution of higher education. They also don't tend to come into judicial service at a very young age when there's a lot of turnover. And so this is not as natural a fit as some other employee groups. But this does provide very much the same sort of option that is currently accorded to legislative staff of the constitutional officers. And it's something that Representative Benson is very interested in.
Ms. Haas and others from the judges, and Mr. Bergstrom, would you like to comment? This would be administered by MSRS.
Yes. Madam Chair, this would go into our unclassified plan if it's passed.
Ms. Haas.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. First, I want to start out by thanking Representative Benson. He did provide a copy of this amendment to us about 2 weeks ago, and we do appreciate the opportunity to review it. It is a complicated topic and hard to digest in the short term. Just as a reminder, the legislation that's before you and Pension Bill 2 brought to you by MDJA was the product of almost 2 years of dialogue to try and solve for the budget the deficiencies that are in the current judge's plan. And that was a product of a lot of discussion with our members and our retirees. As Representative Benson mentioned, we did have an opportunity, both the chair and the vice chair of our Pension and Benefits Committee, to have a dialogue with him this afternoon, listening to him about the goals that he had with presenting the amendment. I suspect Representative Benson won't be as excited about the time and discussion that my client needs to really digest the proposal. They tend to be a thoughtful group, and they believe it's
deliberative group.
Deliberative. And they really think it's important to bring changes like this before the entire judiciary, before they weigh in support of a proposal like this. And so because we have not had the time to do that, we're not in a position to be supportive of this amendment right now. Some additional feedback from judges that I have received since I sent this to them raised some of the same concerns that I brought up the last time I testified, which just is the risking the balance between the adequate pay and benefits that would allow us to attract and retain the best and brightest in the judiciary. And some of the issues that Representative shared with us and Mr. Martin shared is, you know, the kind of the benefits of it are portability and individual choice over investment. And as I talk to judges, those just are not reflective of their priorities right now as it relates to pensions. They do come later in life. They're appointed in their late 40s. They're more likely to stay. This is more likely to be their last job when they move into retirement. And so most are interested in the stability from a pension standpoint. And if I could, Madam Chair, I just want to read an email that I got from a judge who was in the private sector when I sent this out. I think it is really reflective of kind of the initial thoughts and why more dialogue, I think, is necessary should you desire to move in this direction. My experience in private practice was that I was vested in a pension plan with a defined benefit. That plan was part of a total benefits package that enticed me to take the position over two other offers. After some years, it was supplemented with a defined contribution plan. Eventually, the pension plan disappeared, we were left with, what we were left with was a 401k retirement plan plus. It felt like a bait-and-switch tactic and a betrayal of my longevity with that organization. With bad investment advice from my professional certified financial advisor, all the gains in that plan were pretty much wiped out with the Great Recession. I worked for that employer from 1985 to 2001. My 401k plan plus has yet to recover to where it was 12 years ago. That's my personal experience. One of the benefits that attracted me to the bench was the judge's plan. It offered some stability to seasoned professionals as they looked forward to their golden years. With the ground we have lost nationally in terms of our compensation combined with the volatility in the market, this change could be a double whammy to recruitment efforts to fill vacant judgeships. This proposed legislation starts the judge's plan down that same slippery slope that I encountered in private practice. With so many judges retiring over the next few years, we're going to need to recruit a competent, seasoned group of dedicated professionals to the judiciary with an attractive salary and benefits package. Happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Martin, this proposal is an option, right? Optional, it's a voluntary proposal?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So, and there's no default plan, right, that you're, if you don't choose, you're automatically go into defined benefit or defined contribution. It has to be an active choice.
As drafted, yes, Madam Chair.
Any questions from anyone else? Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System, and I don't have a question, but I do.
Yeah, comment.
I am not concerned at all that this does not have a financial impact on the proposal that you have. Under the proposal that we have, we lowered the benefits for future judges to a 2.5% formula. The cost of that program is 14%, 7% employee, 7% employer. So of the 22.5% employer contribution that was going to go to fund the unfunded liability, we were expecting to have 15.5% to do this, where under this proposal, only 13.5% does. So I'm not convinced at all that this protects the plan. I think you also run the risk of adverse selection. You run the risk of a smaller payroll, and I think it needs more study from an actuarial standpoint before you move over. So there is a distinction between the plan we're proposing, which has a 14% cost, from our current plan that has an 18% cost. And that's where the funding issue.
So some people choose the contribution plan. They're not contributing then to the other plan. Therefore, you have less dollars coming in.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The under the proposal that Representative Benson put forward, 13.5% comes to fund the unfunded liability. Under the proposal that's in front of you, 15.5% goes to pay for the unfunded liability. And I just think it needs more discussion and study.
Representative Benson, would you like to make this a topic of an interim hearing?
Well, it sounds like that's where we're headed, Madam Chair. Thank you for that.
Have the plans take a look at it.
I know that it's only had a couple of weeks. I think it absolutely has merit. I think as a committee and a commission, I should say, we need to begin looking at long-term viability, and I think defined contribution gives us the best prospect to be able to do those things. I don't think it's nearly as scary as the testifiers, but then he does it. That's his business. I just teach economics. but I would be happy to speak with him about it more. Maybe there's enough time, Madam Chair, if we were to include it tonight, to have it stripped out in conference, and that gives him enough time to
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I don't find it scary. I just do different math.
Okay. All right.
Concerns at this point, and would like more time to study it.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion, any other comments on the entire package, now Omnibus Bill 2? Ms. Crockett. Ms. Crockett.
I wanted to speak very briefly, Madam Chair, in favor of consideration of the amendment to the judge's plan, and note that you have to ask yourself, who do you want to attract to the bench? People who are looking for safety in their golden years, or people who are looking to serve the people of Minnesota from the bench and perhaps go and do something else, just like the rest of us do in the private sector. So you, whether it's teachers or judges, you have to ask yourself, who are you trying to attract to state service? And consider the possibility that, that people don't stay forever. And you'll get a different group of people and a different revenue stream as a result. I just want to offer finally this afternoon, for all of the matters before you, including para, police, and fire, that there's a resource that's available to us, possibly through something called the Arnold Foundation. They are very committed to helping states like Minnesota solve the pension conundrum that's before us. And I think Minnesota is a great candidate for getting their help. I've been exploring with Mark Haveman and others ways that Arnold might help us fund a study. And what we've discovered is that they want an invitation from, for example, Lori Hacking at TRA or Dave Bergstrom at MSRS or Mary Vanek at PARA, at the Duluth Fund or the St. Paul Fund. They won't do it for a Center of the American Experiment or Mark's group, but they'll do it if a fund comes to them. They have actuaries, independent actuaries, that they will offer to do further analysis to answer some of these very, very tough questions that we all have and most of us, frankly, aren't capable of doing. So I would offer that to you. It's the Arnold Foundation. I'm happy to put anybody in touch with them and help us, you know, as a state, noodle this through, recognizing just how very complex and important all of this is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Crockett. Any questions for her? Okay, well, then we have Omnibus 2 before us, and Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, I move adoption of Omnibus 2 as amended.
Okay, and then I think it's the Delete All Amendment, S1191-1A, and the motion is that a letter will be sent to the Government Operations Committee and the state and local government that this is the approved Pension Commission bill.
Two.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, we had two more business items, and then we'll let Senator Saxhog go. We have a motion that we need to make, and while that's being passed out, Mr. Martin, why don't you explain it?
Members, the last commission meeting, I believe, we did we approved some mortality assumption changes for two volunteer fire plans. One additional pseudo-volunteer fire plan has the same problem and contacted me since that meeting, and that's the motion that you have before you. They have already prepared their actuarial work with a new mortality table, a more up-to-date mortality table, and now have been reminded by the state auditor's office that they need to have it approved by the pension commission before it's an official change. The Bloomington Volunteer Fire Plan is a volunteer fire department, but they base their pension on the salaries of an active patrol officer in Bloomington. And it's a benefit that gets reset every time the wage increase occurs with the Bloomington patrol officers. So it's a little more complicated than the typical volunteer fire plan. A mortality table is more critical, even though it's a small pension plan, because there is a significant life risk with this plan. And it's a plan that has annual or nearly annual post-retirement increases. This one is a little more consequential than New Ulm or Hutchinson. The actuary for the Bloomington Volunteer Fire is the same actuary that the commission uses as our consultant, so this is recommended by our consultant. With that, members, I think it would be appropriate to shift to the RP 2000, a more updated table, a table that we're now using for all of our major public pension plans, rather than the group annuity table, it's a 1972.
Placed 1971.
group annuity mortality table. So this is a significant updating.
So Representative Nelson moves the M2 motion as described by Mr. Martin. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, the last thing we have before us is just I'd like to invite you to email the pension commissions with any suggestions you have on interim topics. As the senior members on the the former members, we're not senior members, we're previous members on the pension commission, know that we would like to maybe meet monthly during the interim. And some things that I have down, we never did talk about our principles. I think that would be a good thing. Those were adopted when Representative Murphy was chair. We can talk about, always talk about the interest rate assumptions. I think that's always important to look at. The role of COLAs. There are some ideas around, and we've had Mr. Triden brought up that issue as well, is should the COLAs be compounded or, you know, some people feel very strongly about maintaining the integrity of the retirees' pension fund, but COLAs are very expensive. I mentioned the defined contribution report that was done last year, that we can re-review that. Representative Benson's proposal to allow judges to have a defined contribution plan. There's some issues that Ms. Crockett brought before us that we could consider. Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, did we look into the hybrid much?
We did have a hearing on that, I think, with Representative Lanning. But we can add that to the list, mm-hmm. kind of the hybrid model. Mm-hmm. And so anything else that you think you'd like? Yeah, Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, last year the Pension Commission in the omnibus bill had a study done that was looking at some PRA-covered people, and I'm very familiar with that because I was the author of that bill, and we never brought it before the commission at this point. We did have a lot of work that was here. Maybe it's something that we would want to look at during the interim that affects certain persons covered by PRA that would earn $425 a month or less in contribution or in wages. And I see others on the commission kind of shaking their head from staff going, oh, yeah, I remember that particular item. I don't need to get into the details, but that is something that maybe they want to brief you a little bit on, and
okay.
We might want to bring that back as some discussion, at least from the standpoint that the commission ordered the study.
Who did
done.
The study?
Ms. Vanek did.
Okay.
And the folks at PERA, so that we can at least bring it before the commission to hear her findings officially and then decide if there's a course of action.
Okay, I'm sorry we didn't hear
done.
Those earlier in the session. I'd forgotten about that.
And again, I just,
Madam
Chair.
We had copies in our packet. We didn't discuss it. Yeah. Anyone else?
Madam Chair, I was thinking about it, but I know we had a lot of things that were in front of us, and I thought that might be something that if we were going to be meeting in the interim, we could give more time and dedication to look at a
right.
kind of a global plan of some action. So thank you.
Right, and Ms. Dieslin said it was in our packets, but we never discussed it,
mm-hmm.
so or had her present it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Okay, thank you very much. Please let me know if you have any other issues to bring before the commission, and thank you very much for being such attentive members. The meeting is adjourned.
Well, I feel like
that's all.